Hello and welcome back to Celluloid Jelly, a podcast featuring a couple of ex-video store guys who just love to talk about movies. I'm CJ Talbot, and joining me as always will be Cesar Alejandro Jr. from Filmsmash.com. For this episode, we're talking the latest Star Wars entry, Rian Johnson's The Last Jedi, and going back to 1984 for Joe Dante's Gremlins. Stick around. And here we are again. We're back. How you doing, Cesar?
I'm doing well, CJ. How are you?
I'm doing great. Yeah. It's, you know, we're recording this, you know, a week before Christmas. Not quite a week before Christmas, but, you know, by the time this gets out, it'll be, you know, Christmas. So Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas, CJ.
Thank you. Thank you.
What's the weather like been over there? I was pretty jealous, I guess, last time we recorded.
It's been nice. I'm not gonna lie, it's been nice. I mean, right now it's sunny and it's a little chilly. It's probably in the lower 60s right now. I think, you know, probably by midday it'll be up to upper 70s.
Yeah. I guess we'd hit the 60s yesterday or 2 days ago. It was uncharacteristically nice.
Yeah, well, right after some snow on the East Coast there, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, wow. So kind of that same Maryland weather, you doesn't know what the hell it's doing.
Yeah, I guess so. It's
yeah. Cool. You know, usually we start off with talking about, you know, the movies that we've seen recently, aside from the main focus of what our podcast is about. And today we're going to be talking about Gremlins, which was directed by Joe Dante and executive produced by Steven Spielberg and written by Chris Columbus. But first, we are going to dig into Star Wars The Last Jedi a little bit. So we're going to throw a spoiler warning out there. If you haven't seen the movie, you probably don't want to listen for the next 10 minutes or so. Because we're gonna get into it. So just general impressions first off, I guess. What'd you think about it, Cesar?
Okay, well, you know, overall, you know, this movie's been seemingly pretty divisive, according to a lot of people I know and follow movie relation and news. Overall, I enjoyed the film quite a bit. I saw the film twice since it was released last Thursday evening. And I think my second viewing, which was yesterday, the movie held up, and I think I liked the film a little bit better after our second viewing.
Okay, yeah, I enjoyed it a lot as well, and, you know, I mean, there were certainly things that I didn't care for, directions that I wouldn't have gone to if I was the filmmaker involved, but I'm not, you know, so, you know, you just kind of have to sit back and go with it. You know, this film has been touted as, like, the Star Wars movie that changes everything. I'm not sure I'd go that far. I'm not really sure it changes a whole lot. I know the dynamic about, you know, that we had in the original trilogy, which was sort of like the Sith and the Apprentice, is now gone from this particular trilogy since, Snoke is dead. You know, I like that. And it leaves us with the question of, because we don't already understand the dynamic of that, like, where do they go from here, kind of, with Kylo Ren and with the dark side, quote-unquote, or whatever. Do you want to talk about anything that you really liked before we talk about stuff you didn't like, or?
Okay. Well, overall, I think the movie, when it hits its highs, the highs are amazing. probably my favorite scene in the entire film is the return of the Jedi scene when Snoke is confronted by Rey.
Okay.
And the resulting, I guess, fight that happens in there, I thought was excellent. Very well done.
Yeah, and it's production design wise and art direction wise, it's a beautiful set. Lots of vibrant color, a lot of red and gold. And I think, you know, when Snoke dies and the lightsaber comes out and Rey grabs it, and she and Kylo Ren sort of like turn their backs to one another to face off against the guards. That particular shot, as the camera moves in on that, it's a little bit of slow motion, right?
Yeah, for a little bit, but then I think it
sort of ramps back up, right? It kind of starts in slow motion and then like goes to like regular speed.
Yeah, instead of lingering or changing the cut, they just slow down that moment so people have a chance to savor it for just that little bit longer, I guess.
Yeah, that's a great shot. And it's a moment that I think, even though I don't think it took people, it definitely didn't take me by surprise, but it still was only one of many possibilities of how that scene could have played out. So it was still exciting.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, the fight scenes are good. I think it's interesting that J.J. Abrams, when he did The Force Awakens, kind of went back to less choreography in the lightsaber battles, and they're sort of carrying that through here as well. So like it feels like a bit less graceful and a little bit dirtier fight style than in the prequels.
Probably, well, you know, definitely a little bit more raw, probably more realistic, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. That being said, I certainly think that this film, in contrast to The Force Awakens, I'm choosing my words carefully here, embraces the entire Star Wars saga in a way that The Force Awakens does not. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the Force Awakens went out of its way to not acknowledge the existence of the prequels. With the exception of including Ewan McGregor's Obi-Wan in a little sliver in Rey's vision, his voice, like there's nothing that references the prequels really. And in this one, they reference the prequels quite a bit. As far as talking about Darth Sidious, there's actually John Williams uses musical callbacks to the prequels as well. The march that they use for like the Trade Federation in The Phantom Menace, they reuse in this movie. And I think a lot of the little bits of humor that Rian Johnson peppers throughout this film with the porgs and things like that definitely feel more in line and comparable to the prequels than the original trilogy.
You know, I thought the movie going into it, you know, there was a lot of discussion about how people were worried or how the film was like an Empire Strikes Back rehash.
Right.
I honestly felt there were more than a couple of cues in this film that remind me more of Return of the Jedi as opposed to Empire.
Right. And, you know, I think that throws you a little bit. It takes you by surprise because, you know, this movie, it doesn't wrap up the story, obviously. There's a whole other movie coming and there are definitely loose threads. But it really closes off some of the things that you expect out of a Star Wars movie, like that master-apprentice dynamic. And that was a big surprise.
I think the fallout immediately after that, too. One of the big questions following The Force Awakens, of course, was the question of Rey's parentage.
Oh, yeah.
And I absolutely love the way they handled it in this film.
Me too.
I think that's something I was very glad about. I was hoping against hope, but thankfully it panned out, you know, in my favor in terms of Rey not being related to any of the well-known Jedis, aka the Skywalker clan, with her being a super powerful Jedi, but having no history. I really enjoyed the kind of the future possibilities to be had in next films.
Yeah, and it really, you know, one of my big problems with the prequels, which I don't hate, I'm one of those people who certainly can enjoy them for what they are, and I'd rather have them than not have them. But one of the big problems is that Lucas tried to tie everything together with the prequels, you know, Anakin building C-3PO and all that stuff, and it was just a really small galaxy. And if Rey had been Obi-Wan's granddaughter or something like that, like it just would have continued that sort of like inside baseball small galaxy kind of thing going on, and I'm glad they didn't do that, because you know, when you, if you think back to this whole, you know, 9 film series, this episodic Star Wars thing is a Skywalker story, you know, starting with Anakin, who was a slave boy raised from nothing, And ending with Kylo Ren, or at least we expect it to end with Kylo Ren at this point. And the idea that Rey is coming from nothing and that her parents don't matter within the grand scheme of the story is realistic and fresh from a Star Wars perspective.
Yeah.
And I like the way that scene plays out because she knows it in her heart. You can tell. And Kylo senses it, you know, and he can't have that information unless she has it. Like, you know, how can he really know?
Yeah, I mean, you could lie to yourself, I guess.
Yeah. Like, he maybe saw that when he was in her head in the first movie, or when they were kind of connected, which is something that we need to talk about it too. Okay. When they're sort of connected in this movie. But, you know, that's a big step for Rey to admit that that she needs to find her place, that perhaps she has no place, but she sort of is compelled to be a part of it anyway.
Yeah, I think for her thread, her storyline thread, that point, you know, is the moment that frees her. In Force Awakens, she's always considering, you know, returning back. And,
yeah, to Jakku.
Remaining comfortable, maybe not comfortable, but, you know, to a place of familiarity. Sure. But this one, I think her revelation frees her to take a more central role. I mean, she's as a central role in what, maybe not destiny, but what she decides to make for herself.
Right. And I think that...
The paraphrase Terminator, I guess.
I think you hit the nail on the head there, because I think that's a big overarching, dramatic point in this series, is that destiny is not playing as much of a part in this. It's about people choosing their own destiny. The way that Finn chooses to leave the First Order, the way that Rey chooses to take up with the fight, and the way that Kylo Ren chooses to pursue the dark side over the light. And I think that will continue in the third movie with whatever J.J. Abrams decides to do.
Colin Trevorrow was attached to that film. Did they start principal photography, or was he just removed during pre-production?
Oh, no. He was removed during the script stage. Okay. I'm obviously not privy to any, real insider information, but the reports that came out when he was fired was that he... made a couple different pitches and no one was ever happy with it. And they got a first draft of a script that nobody liked. And so at that point they were like, this isn't working. So I don't know if they had a lot of art and production design and things like that that they were working on. But I heard that J.J. Abrams basically started from scratch, and he recently just pitched his version of Episode 9 to Disney this past Friday, the day that Last Jedi came out. So things are moving along with Episode 9, but I think, you know, I think as much as there are things in Force Awakens that I'm not that crazy about, I do think it's an enjoyable movie, and I think JJ will probably do a pretty good job with the third one.
Yeah, hopefully. I think he's the type of guy that can address criticism, especially if he agrees with it too. Force Awakens definitely was a movie where he probably didn't have as much creative freedom as he's used to. And I think that after Rian Johnson's entry, in which a lot of things get turned on its head, and some new ideas were introduced, I think J.J. Abrams, he could probably take that ball and run with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have confidence that he's going to give us at least an entertaining movie. I want to go back real quick and talk about... some other characters in this particular movie, starting with the original trilogy characters. Obviously, Luke and Leia have big parts in this movie. One of the things that I don't like about this movie, and I also didn't care for it in The Force Awakens, is that a lot of the original trilogy characters seem to be obligatory to the series, that they're just sort of there for fan service. And I think in this film, C-3PO, R2-D2, and Chewbacca all have very, very little to do. Yeah, obviously Chewbacca pilots the Falcon in the fight at the end of the movie, the battle. And R2 has that one nice moment with Luke in the Falcon where he plays the original recording of Leia's plea to Obi-Wan Kenobi, which actually, I really like that scene. I think that's a nice callback. But for the most part, they've got nothing to do. And that's, you know, this is about moving forward with Star Wars and introducing new characters and things like that. But I kind of feel like there was maybe something better to do with them, especially Chewie. In the other scenes that he's in, like with Luke, he's just kind of sitting there in the background as Luke will talk to Rey. Like, he doesn't need to be there. He's just there as a prop.
Set dressing.
Yeah. And the scene where Chewie is going to eat a porg, I know a lot of people really loved that scene, but I find it cringeworthy.
You know, I didn't care for that scene either. I was curious to what a pork tasted like, though. It looked delicious.
Tastes like chicken.
It looked like cartoon food, and you know, like cartoon food always looks better than real food, I guess.
Yeah, tastes like Mogwai.
So like yummy. Chinese food.
Yeah. Oh man. All right. And that particular scene with Chewie and the porgs. Feels very prequel-y to me. That feels like something George Lucas would have put into Episode 1.
Yeah, let's sell pork collectibles.
Well, I can't blame them for wanting to sell toys. I mean, this franchise has been making billions of dollars off of that since Lucas's earliest days.
Yeah, sure.
So you know that's why we have the Ewoks. But you know that scene
another
just
example,
was
example of the film being similar to Return of the Jedi. I thought immediately the porgs were analogous to the Ewoks, just, you know, even more useless, I guess.
Yeah, because they don't overthrow the First Order or anything like that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. You want to talk about Leia?
I want to hear what you want to say about Leia first.
I think Carrie Fisher is pretty good in this movie. And I think she's certainly given a lot more to do here than she was given in The Force Awakens by design. I like her relationship with Poe and the idea that she's trying to groom him into a leader, knowing that maybe she won't be around forever, which, you know, at the time we thought Carrie Fisher would be in all three of these movies. And her death has certainly put a monkey wrench into whatever Abrams wants to do in the next movie. But generally, I like her in the movie. The only thing that I would point out, I really don't like the scene where she flies through space using the Force after the explosion. It seems very awkward to me, visually, and just conceptually odd as well.
I agree. I think there's nothing that she has to do after the film, except Luke and Leia meeting again at the end of the picture that necessitates her staying alive. They gave her a natural way out. I think if she had done what Laura Dern's character had done, that would have been a fine way, you know, to say goodbye to her.
Yeah, yeah. Laura Dern's character, I really like her a lot, and I'm sorry that she's not going to be in the other movies.
I thought she was pretty good.
Yeah, and I like that. You know, you kind of don't know where she's coming from at first, and then, you know, gradually you get a sense that she is buying time, you know, for the evacuation, and then, you know, it's sort of revealed that she knew what she was doing all along, and then she dies a heroic death in the coolest way possible, like that scene where the cruiser goes into light speed and shards of it go through, like, all the Star Destroyers and everything. When they take the sound out of it, like, it was a real, like, satisfying moment. And in both screenings, because I saw it twice too, in both screenings, the audience gasped in that moment both times.
Yeah, my group too.
Yeah.
Definitely the gasp was a lot louder on the opening night screening too, though, but of course.
Yeah, so I do like that a lot. So I think Leia's used well in the movie, and to be honest, I don't mind that she doesn't die in the explosion. I like the idea that she's the rallying point that the Resistance carries with them. You know, even later in the film, when she's like, use my personal code to send out the distress signal, when Finn comes back and he has his sort of like arc in the movie, you know, his sort of Han Solo arc from deserter to stand up guy. He's like, you know, people believe in Leia, you know, people will come. We just have to buy some time. And I think if she's not around, I think that, you know, that moment can't exist, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
Do you want to talk about Luke? You can start. You can start about Luke.
Okay. Well, I think from the very beginning, it's not just with Luke, but the movie in general tends to defy expectation, I guess. You find Luke on this island. He's living as a hermit. He seemingly, you know, we find out, of course, that he's later on kind of blocked himself off from Force Sense and everything.
Right.
And he's
that seems like a way to protect himself, I think. To make sure that he's not being sensed by Kylo Ren or Snoke, or Leia, to protect her as well.
Well, I think that it might be, absolutely, that's true. But I wonder if the Force is something you can kind of, like, switch on and off with a light, like a switch, but, I guess it is.
Well, I don't know much about like chi, but like in order to tap into like a person's chi, don't you have to be like, it doesn't happen naturally. You have to try to do it, right? You have to sort of like center yourself and like reach out.
Yeah, certainly. I guess the Star Wars, particularly the tenets that kind of govern the Force, tend to have a lot of leanings and inspiration from Eastern mythology and medicine and, I guess, belief.
Right.
There's, you know, meditation, there's the warrior aspect. It's pretty easy to spot these things if you're familiar with the possible sources for them. For Luke, though, I think he's got a very interesting arc in that he's, you know, obviously a recluse, but like Rey doesn't necessarily break through his shell, but he's still open to what she has to say during the end of her visit there. So her influence and her appearance is very important to his, I guess, kind of soul searching, which possibly is what he's been there for the whole time.
Right. I think you're right as far as like expectation versus, you know, what Rian Johnson does in this. You know, when we first see Luke, where, you know, she hands him the lightsaber, he doesn't even like look at it for 10 seconds. You know, it's not even clear. I'm sure he does, but it's not even clear that he recognizes it as the lightsaber that it is. And he just sort of tosses it over his shoulder in a very, like, I heard somebody refer to it as a Spaceballs moment. And I kind of like that description of it, you know, because it's sort of like a rubbing the fan's nose into, like, you know, you're expecting Luke to have some grand like emotional moment there and question who Rey is and you know, like almost be waiting for the student to find the teacher, which is you know, one of those like Joseph Campbell things, but nope, he's just like tosses it over his shoulder. I think that moment and like him drinking the milk.
The blue milk. So that's where they come from, huh? I guess.
Yeah, I guess it looks a little blue green in this movie, but you know, maybe they just ship that stuff out all over the galaxy. So Aunt Beru had a you know, a carton of blue milk in the fridge.
Had a connection.
Yeah. He's been weaned on that blue milk his whole life.
Well, I guess, you know, maybe it's different, you know, like the difference between cow's milk and goat milk and stuff.
Maybe.
And Tatooine desert cows or something.
Yeah. Now, you know, obviously, he's really a central focus of this movie. You know, obviously he's got his back and forth with Rey. You know, you've got the revelation of what happened with Kylo Ren or Ben Solo. You've got the moment with Yoda, the return of Yoda to the franchise.
I thought that scene was really good.
I do like that scene. It does feel like a digression a little bit. I mean, it's important for Luke's character, but like where it's situated in the movie, like, I don't know. It kind of felt, it feels a little long to me.
Well, I mean, it happens immediately after. So, I mean, the presence of Yoda appears when, as soon as Rey leaves, Luke is ready to destroy the tree that houses the Jedi techs, yeah?
Yeah. Which he doesn't know is missing, but yeah. Did I lose you?
No, I'm still here. Oh. So, I mean, that was my point. That, like, in terms of position in the timeline of the movie, I think it was fine.
Yeah. It's good. It's good. And Yoda, like, I like the idea that they actually created a Yoda puppet to animate as opposed to, like, going CGI with it.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And that, you know, that Luke needed to realize that his failings were as important to learn from as anything he could teach someone. His big redemptive moment at the end of the film, how do you feel about that?
I'm fine with it, to be honest with you. Like, I think it would have been better for more. I think more people would have preferred him to actually be there in person. I guess they were expecting some kind of great show of Jedi prowess from Luke versus Kylo Ren. I know a lot of the extended universe features Luke going way beyond anything Vader was capable of. But of course, you know, that's not canon. So of course, people have no idea the true potential of a Jedi, only what we've seen in the films generally. I think his force projection from the water planet to, I guess, the mining rebel base planet was an interesting way to do it. And overall, like, I thought it was a fine reveal. The audience seemed to enjoy it. It was just a series of kind of wow moments or surprise. And I think it's a good job. It does a good job of keeping you on your toes, certainly.
Yeah.
I was really surprised at how quickly he cleaned up, though, I guess.
Yeah. Well, he looks maybe even a little bit younger, but yeah, the haircut's different. Looks like his beard is a little bit more trimmed, and he obviously wearing nicer clothes. I guess that might tip off the really savvy viewer who's expecting like a twist in that. But I think most of the audience just assumed, you know, he got dressed and cleaned up and got in his X-wing fighter that he raised up out of the ocean and jetted off to help out. I don't mind the force projection stuff. It's silly to imagine that we've seen everything possible that the force can do. And I think that they do a nice job. I think Rian Johnson does a nice job of sort of setting up the idea earlier in the film through the connection that Rey and Kylo Ren have.
Yeah, there's the line when Kylo says, when they first connect, he says to Rey, "There's no way you're capable of this. It would kill you."
Right.
The strain would kill you, of course. So, I mean, I guess the force connection between Kylo Ren and Rey, maybe that's a Sith ability, perhaps. And the force projection that Luke uses is kind of like the counter ability that they use for the Jedi.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if going forward we're going to be dealing with the Force in terms of Jedi versus Sith and stuff like that. But yeah, as far as like dark side versus light, I think the abilities are obviously the way they tap into the Force gives them different avenues in which to use it, maybe. I wasn't necessarily expecting Luke to be revealed to not be there. But as soon as that happened, what I thought back to was them touching hands in the hovel.
Oh, sure.
And the idea that they could actually feel one another and that they could actually, you know, cross space and time through the Force and actually connect that way physically. So it made a lot of sense to me, and I like the idea that it's sort of set up throughout the film.
Yeah, you know, the transporting of water and matter, and I think, you know, it's present there for foreshadowing, but I definitely agree that it wasn't telegraphed, though.
Right. I didn't even mention that, but yeah, when you mentioned the water, like when Kylo Ren has water on his hand after talking with Rey when she's underneath the Millennium Falcon, like, yes, because it's raining outside. Yeah, that's a good point. So yeah, it's peppered throughout. So like I think he does a really good job with that. You know, it's an entertaining movie. I mean, people are up in arms about this for no good reason, I think, to be honest.
Well, they're up in arms because of Star Wars, and
right, but here's
complain about it no matter what.
I'm as guilty of analyzing and picking apart and complaining about things I don't like as anybody else is, but I still watch and enjoy the movies. Like, I'm not signing fan petitions and telling people I'm not going to buy tickets to the next movie. You know,
I think that's absolutely ridiculous, because the people that say they're not going to buy tickets to the next movie, you sure as ass know that they're going to be over there watching that film with everyone else.
Yeah, so instead of a $220 million opening for Episode 9, it'll be a $218 million opening. So, like, yeah, you know, fuck
it'll
you.
Probably be $230 million.
Yeah, probably. Come see the conclusion of the final chapter in the newest Star Wars.
I know I said
movie.
I wouldn't, but delete my tweet from 2 years ago.
Save that. That's going to be a Saturday Night Live sketch, I guarantee it.
Okay.
you could say that you prophesized it.
Oh, yeah, I'll be like The Simpsons.
Yeah. Oh, Disney Fox. There you go. Yeah. That's, ooh. I'm not sure I even want to get into that, but wow.
I was really surprised at how quickly they got Hugh Jackman as Wolverine in this movie. Spoiler alert.
When Thanos shows up and kills Snoke, it's very unexpected.
Yeah, really. I was surprised. And he take, you know. Man, I can't wait to see what lightsaber they make out of those Infinity Gems.
Yeah. Oh, man. All right, anything else you want to talk about before we move on to Gremlins?
Okay, well, I really like...
we didn't talk about Rose. Like, how do you feel about Rose?
In particular, I really like... I liked her character arc a lot. I mean, I think initially when you see her, she's in this kind of fangirl-ish mode. And... I mean, I guess it was a little bit, not annoying, but I didn't care for the character as much. But I think as she grows during the film and as you find out more about her, you know, she endears herself to you very easily. Plus, you know, having Asian actors and actresses in a film, for me in particular, is something that's always very welcome. So it was nice to see. I think her line... of course, the line on the salt planet. I thought that was a very lovely moment. And
oh yeah, about that's how we win.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I guess her inspiration, which is I guess the final scene in the film, of course, is I guess the children on the casino planet talking about what happened with Luke Skywalker on the salt planet.
Right.
So, you know, kind of cultivating the seeds of the rebellion. I think her inspiration of that little kid who takes her ring was really good. I thought that finale made me feel really, really great at the end of the film.
Yeah, it's very it's a positive message, and it sort of I like the moment it leaves you on because it's nothing but possibility. You know that the characters who are speeding away in the Millennium Falcon are going to continue the fight, but even though it seems dire and that they are so few in numbers. Like, the idea that the next generation will fight this battle too, and that more people will grow and join them, is a very positive message. Something,
yeah,
that,
absolutely.
You know...
Like, especially with, I guess, the young boy who gets the ring at the end. I mean, they kind of hint that he's got Force powers.
Well, not just hint. I mean, he uses the Force to get the broom. It moves, like, right, 2 feet. It's like some Harry Potter shit.
Yeah, one of the things I thought was really cool, I mean, obviously you set up the fact that Rey's from nowhere, and then look at where this young boy is at.
Absolutely.
If you look at the history of Star Wars, how many millions of people around the world, particularly children, have watched one of these films and go outside, look at the stars, and pretend a broom is a lightsaber?
Yeah, absolutely.
In particular really hit me, and it was kind of a reinforcement of why I really like the Star Wars films, not just for entertainment value or you know, lightsaber battles, all the cool stuff. But I think at its core, the movie has the ability to franchise in general to inspire people, which, you know, I think goes a long way. And even people who deride film, like this most recent film or the prequels or whatever have you, nothing's above criticism. But I don't. But I think people can't deny how much inspiration like these films have given to the world at large. You know.
I think that's a terrific point, and a really beautiful sentiment. You know, as far as like the power of cinema goes, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, when you look at the generation that grew up with the original Star Wars trilogy, you know, many of those people were inspired to become NASA scientists or filmmakers or musicians or anything else, or perhaps were inspired to, you know, join the military and make a career out of protecting our country. So you don't know how it can affect people on such a personal level, and movies in general do that, but in particular, you're absolutely right. Star Wars has an intense ability to do that with people too. That's it. I could feel myself getting ready to like explode. I wanted to say more, so I just stopped.
Okay.
Because, I mean, you
maybe
know,
maybe that's a good Star Wars. That's a good stopping point then. So.
Yeah. Well, the only thing I would say is that you know, it probably doesn't need to be said, but you know, obviously these films in this new trilogy of Star Wars have so much better representation. Not just with different races, but with gender, and there are a lot of women at the forefront of this movie. Rose's sister is a big part of that opening sequence, and her death. You know, she's not a Force user, and she's just a bomber pilot. You know, somebody. She's not even a fighter pilot. She's not somebody that would typically be a hero to someone. Obviously, she's a hero to her sister, you know, but I think, you know, her story is one that those children may end up telling as well. And her death is cool, you know, as far as like the visuals and stuff go. I actually really like the shot where they pull the camera back through the bomber bay as the bombs are dropping. Like the camera sort of like shifts position and pulls backwards. And that's a really good shot in the film that I liked. But yeah, you know, so you've got Laura Dern's character and you've got, Carrie Fisher's daughter, you know, has a, I don't know if you'd call it an extended cameo, small part, whatever you want to call it, but she's an important player. She helps Poe Dameron to get Finn and Rose off the ship.
She's a traitor.
Yeah. Well, she's doing what she thinks is right, you know, and she's, you know, she was loyal to General Leia, I assume, and Poe Dameron was loyal to General Leia. So when this new person comes and takes over, you know, of course they're doing what they think General Leia would do, you know, by fighting the fight. Mm-hmm. You know, and
they rebel.
Right. And you've got the other, I don't know the actress's name or the character's name, but the woman who actually says General Leia is unconscious and we have Vice Admiral Holden coming over to take over control. But that, you know, that's another woman in a position of power in this film. You know, obviously that's a very calculated move on the part of Rian Johnson and probably Lucasfilm, who is headed itself by a woman, Kathleen Kennedy, you know, to show women in power, to show diversity, you know, in these films. And I love it. You know, I mean, it doesn't, I didn't think about it while watching the movie. I thought about it after the movie was over. But yeah, like it's much better for the long run. And it sort of, you know, Star Wars is an all ages, all genders kind of a story anyway, because you've got, you know, Princess Leia and Padme and, you know, a bunch of other women characters that have drawn girls into the saga already. But, you know, showing them throughout, not just as one hero, but as a collective womanhood, you know, within the resistance, you know, within the First Order and things like that, I think is a necessary thing. probably going on about this too long, so we should probably move on. But
okay, well, I guess how about maybe we'll have like we'll start a thread in the group for spoilers, and then I'm sure there are plenty of people who want to jump in. Maybe get the discussion started even before this episode gets posted, which I'm assuming you'll probably get done pretty soon.
Yeah, I'll make sure this is out before Christmas. Okay. The one thing I would say, you know, as far as to address it to the group and the people who you know support us and talk and comment and like and share our stuff, is just to keep it civil and to make sure that if you disagree with somebody, to do it respectfully.
Yeah, and, you know, make sure there's smiley faces at the end.
Yeah. Even though you're joking. this is probably going to be a long episode. So, did you see anything else besides Star Wars recently that you want to talk about before we move into Gremlins?
I guess the only notable film I really saw, I watched Assassin's Creed, which is pretty bad.
Ooh, Fassbender.
I watched Mark Webb's film Gifted, starring Chris Evans.
Oh, and is that Alice Eve?
Who's
in that with him?
It's Jenny Slate,
Octavia
Spencer, and a young actress named McKenna Gold. Have you seen the trailer for this film?
Yeah, I think I was mixing it up with the movie that he directed, which came out maybe a year or two ago.
Oh yeah, that movie wasn't good.
Okay.
I saw that earlier this year sometime, but it wasn't good.
Okay, but this one was?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Cool. I think...
I like Jenny Slate.
Yeah, the movie was very tender. Very heartfelt. It was a pretty nice dramatic comedy. And it hit a lot of points I really like. In particular, there's a handful of scenes that I think were pretty terrific. And I think they're when the year is done, I'll consider them some of my favorite scenes. I'm not sure where I'll place the movie in terms of like my top 10 or ranking as best films of the year that I've seen. But the movie was a pretty big surprise. I thought the trailer was interesting, but the movie kind of surpassed my expectations.
Cool. Yeah, I'll have to check it out. That sounds good. Now, let me ask you this. Chris Evans, outside of the Fantastic Four franchise and the Marvel Studios franchise where he plays Captain America, has had a tough time really sort of nailing down, like, what he is outside of superhero genres. Do you think he's going to have, you know, a big career once he leaves Captain America behind him?
You know, it's tough to say. Going off this film, which I guess is might be his most recent theatrical release aside from the Marvel films. I've thought that Chris Evans, he's a good actor. He's not a great actor. But this movie showed a marked improvement. Maybe improvement is not the right word, but a marked increase in depth for him as an actor.
Okay.
I think if he continues to grow, like the way he grew in this film compared to, you know, that movie he directed himself. I can't recall the title, the one with Alice Eve yet.
Sorry, Chris.
Your performance in Gifted was quite good.
Nice.
But I think he's got a chance. It's always tough to kind of break away from a character that everyone knows you from. I mean, that's one of the classic things about, like, the James Bond franchise or anything, or, you know, or Daniel Radcliffe. Like, is he ever going to get past, you know, Harry Potter, despite him being a pretty decent actor in his own right?
I'll tell you what, the things that I've seen him in outside of Harry Potter, he's been really good in. And I think he's taking some real risks with stuff like Swiss Army Man and things like that.
I thought that movie What If with Adam Driver was pretty damn good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Haven't caught that one yet. You know, it seems like you really need to work hard when you leave that image behind you. Like, you know, I think that's essentially, you know, the thing. You said James Bond and Harry Potter, and, you know, I know when you look at Star Wars, which is what we were just talking about, Harrison Ford, Carrie Fisher, and Mark Hamill all had careers outside of Star Wars, But Harrison Ford was the only one to have a larger career than his role of Han Solo, whereas Mark Hamill had a very small career, and he's very notable for especially his voicing the Joker in the Batman animated series, because that has such a huge fan base. But you know, everything else has been very small roles for him, in TV and movies,
the Guyver and stuff.
Well, and like Kingsman, he's great in the first Kingsman.
I definitely think that like his voice work has probably enabled him to become a more expressive and better actor since like his days in Star Wars too.
Yeah, I think he's pretty good in The Last Jedi. I know it's against expectations and stuff, but like some of his line readings and facial expressions, I really dig in that too.
Sure.
So yeah. I think you're right. Yeah. He does seem a little off these days, though. Have you been watching any, like, interviews and stuff?
The only one I saw was the Graham Norton interview that he did with other cast members.
Oh, that was a pretty good one, though, when he talks about, like, the reveal in Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah. The one where
he says, Obi-Wan killed your father instead of, yeah. I am your father. Yeah. That's something that I knew already, but it's still a cool story.
Yeah, I mean, I'd read that anecdote somewhere before, but yeah. Hearing him speak about it and animatedly, so it's pretty nice to watch it anyway.
Yeah, and then they had him like throw an orange, and then they reversed it back to to give it that like force pull. Yeah, the force pull. I love the Graham Norton show. We're really getting off topic here, but I think Graham Norton, like he's definitely got the best like late night English talk show. So.
I don't watch much television, but I'll catch certain, depending on the guests, I'll catch them.
I'll tell you, I've never sat down and watched a full episode of Graham Norton, but there are times where, like, it'll pop up in my YouTube feed, and I'll just watch Graham Norton clips for, like, an hour. He's so giddy and has so much fun with his guests, and it's a very loose atmosphere, unlike something like The Tonight Show or something, where, like, somebody's behind a desk and then somebody else is like on a couch. Like they're all basically like sitting in a circle or a semicircle and interacting with each other in a different way than you typically see with American talk shows. And I think that brings out, a better interview. A lot of the people really just enjoy the setting. So,
yeah, you know, it's tea time or like a dinner conversation.
Yeah.
Dinner conversation or something.
So, and he gets killer guests. He's always got great guests. So, all right, anyway, were you done talking about Chris Evans?
I guess so.
I mean,
what about you? Was there a movie you want to talk about that you saw recently?
So I was taking a drink of water. I've seen a number of movies over the past week, and I did get a chance to see Star Wars twice, but I also saw a few others. The only one, I guess, that I'll mention... because I want to make sure that if people know it's good that they go see it or find a way to see it when it hits on demand or DVD or whatever, is The Florida Project. The only real noteworthy actor in it is Willem Dafoe, but it takes place just outside of Orlando, Florida.
I really wanted to watch that film.
It's so good. It's really good. It's from Sean Baker, who did Tangerine 2 years ago, which was also really, really good. And that movie did not get a huge release, probably because of the material and the subject matter, because it dealt with trans people. But it was quite good. And Sean Baker has a visual style that doesn't come along very often. I just love his eye and the way he shoots things, and it's not precise the way that something like a David Fincher or a Paul Thomas Anderson would be. It's a looser style, but he shot Tangerine on an iPhone. I believe he shot Florida Project with 35mm. I might be mistaken on that, but I think it's 35mm. But it has a very similar feel to Tangerine, even though the texture of it is very different. And it deals with the inhabitants of a sort of small-time nickel-and-dime-like motel outside of Orlando, Florida. And, you know, being like right outside of Orlando, you know, that's where Disney World is, you know, Magic Kingdom, and it's supposed to be like the happiest place in the world. And this motel is sort of populated by people who are on the fringe. They're poor people. They're scraping by. You know, they don't know what they're going to do to pay their rent for the motel every week. And it follows, you know, a group of kids and their parents throughout the film. And I don't want to give too much away. I'm trying not to babble on about it. But there's a real affection, or maybe affection's the wrong word, but there's a real, like, empathy to Baker as a filmmaker. He is not judging these people. He's not condemning them for their behavior, you know, for the things that they do in order to live day by day. You know, many of them are, you know, doing things that are illegal. But the way he works with the kids in this movie is delightful and probably the most realistic portrayal of like 4 to 7 year old kids that maybe I've ever seen on film.
Oh yeah.
And Willem Dafoe is terrific. I mean, really terrific, like fucking terrific, as like the manager of the place. And it's called the Magic Castle. And there's a funny scene in the movie where like a honeymoon couple arrives there and they don't speak English and they thought they were booking their honeymoon at the Magic Kingdom, but it's the Magic Castle. And that provides for some humor. So, but it's really, really good. I'm going to stop there, because I don't want to, you know, really get into it too much, but it's not going to be a movie for everybody. But if you watch the trailer and you have any interest, it's a beautifully made film, and a very human film. So I definitely recommend it very highly.
Yeah. That's one I saw the trailer and I was pretty smitten with like what it presented. It sounds like the movie is even beyond what I wanted, beyond what I expected. So yeah. That's one I've been dying to see, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, definitely check it out. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. So.
Okay.
Cool. On to Gremlins. Wow, we're like 52 minutes into this, like, and we're just now talking about Gremlins.
That special size for Christmas, I guess.
That's right. It's a gift from us to you.
No coal for you kids today.
So, what's Gremlins about, Cesar?
Well, Gremlins is a Christmas set film about a young man named Billy Peltzer, who receives a Mogwai, which is a kind of mystical creature for Christmas from his father. The creature comes with a set of rules in which, of course, the characters violate.
Ridiculous rules, yes.
The characters violate these rules, which are never expose them to sunlight, never feed them after midnight, and never get them wet. And, of course, it springs a series of events where the Mogwai proliferates into murderous and mischievous creatures, a.k.a. gremlins. Of, you know, Twilight Zone fame.
Right. Perfect.
Absolutely perfect.
And they turn this suburban middle American town upside down.
Yeah. When was the last time you sat down and watched Gremlins before the screening that we, before the screening you used for this discussion?
Dude, it had been a really long time. To be honest, this is what I found amazing about this. I don't think I ever saw Gremlins in the movie theater. I'm pretty sure I saw Gremlins on TV first, probably like HBO or something.
Oh yeah, I'm the same way.
And I must have watched it a bunch, because I haven't seen this movie in at least 15 years. At least 15 years.
I feel like it's been 20 years for me.
Yeah, it's probably for me too. But I felt like I still remembered the lines and knew the beats, and it just, like, I don't know how to describe it. It wasn't like deja vu or anything like that, but like I was amazed at how much of it was still kind of like readily available in my brain. So,
I felt, you know, I didn't, maybe not to that degree, but for me, having been, you know, like I said, over 20 years probably since I had seen it, the beats of the film I remembered vividly, like certain scenes, like the movie theater, or because they watched Snow White, and I've said, I don't know if I've said it on the podcast, but I've said many times that the first film I ever saw in a theater was Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Right, yep.
But like there are moments in the film which stick out like immensely, way more than, say, other films that I watch all the time, I think. Gremlins, to me, probably kind of encapsulates a lot of that Steven Spielberg-esque fantasy and joy of movies that I really associate with my childhood.
Yeah. Well, this was the first Amblin Entertainment picture. So even though, you know, most people would throw E.T. and Poltergeist into there, like, he didn't have the company up and running for those movies. So, like, this is the first one to carry the Amblin Entertainment logo on it. But yeah, you're right. It has all the hallmarks of that. And I mentioned earlier, it's like a small suburban town, which is something that all the Amblin films have in common. You know, whether it be Poltergeist, E.T., Goonies, Gremlins, they all sort of have that middle class suburbia aspect to it, which comes from, I guess, Spielberg's childhood. And yeah, I mean, this particular town, which I think was on the Warner backlot, or actually it's the Universal backlot. It's the same town square that Back to the Future was shot on.
Yeah, I mean, like, there are many moments in the film, particularly towards the end, during the snow cover sequence, where the town seemed familiar, and I was, you know, scratching my head to try to figure out which towns it could have stood in for. Like, in my mind, I didn't think Back to the Future. In my mind, I was thinking, like, The Blob or something.
Mm. Well, they've used that for so many movies, so, you know, that's why it becomes very familiar. But I think they do a good job of sort of masking it, especially in the night scenes, because everything's covered in snow, which is usually not the case when you're watching it, and darkness. So,
yep.
So that definitely helps hide it. It does look like a set, though. Like, the Burger King in particular, like, I laughed out loud when I saw the Burger King, because it's obviously not a Burger King.
At the beginning of the movie? Yeah. When he's walking to work.
It's like the fakest looking Burger King ever.
Like, they may as well have put like a Burger King coming soon up there.
Yeah, yeah. And there was nobody in it. Like, no Burger King bags, nobody coming out with a hamburgers or a smile on their face.
Kingston Falls is a McDonald's town.
I guess so. Yeah. Well, you know, there was originally a McDonald's that was supposed to be in the movie. One of the early drafts of the script was much darker. And there were a lot of differences. Here, I'll run down a couple for you. Billy's mother died in her struggle with the gremlins originally. And
badass.
Yeah, she gets decapitated and her head gets thrown down the stairs when Billy arrives at home.
Come on, Joe Dante, come on, man.
Well, that would have been Chris Columbus, but so luckily they didn't do that. There's also a scene where the gremlins ate Billy's dog Barney.
Oh, thankfully. Now, let me ask you something. Did it look like that was really a dog hanging by lights?
Yeah.
Okay, that seemed pretty mean to them. You know, I don't think something like that wouldn't get by today, probably.
Well, but it doesn't look like the dog's in any kind of pain. It's just hanging there. So I think they could do that today.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. And like, I was really kind of like, ugh. I didn't remember it looking like as, maybe not, didn't look uncomfortable necessarily, but, you know, surprising is all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they still, like, I don't know, I didn't look in the credits, but I'm pretty sure they still had, like, animal control people on the set back in the 80s, too, so.
Yeah, you know, I guess, you know, immediately after, like, Twilight Zone.
I'm sure, yeah. Well, that's a whole different thing, so, but getting back to the McDonald's thing real quick, there was a scene originally in the script where the gremlins attacked a McDonald's, and instead of eating the burgers, they ate the customers.
So it was like the clown, like the clown burger scene in Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Ooh, maybe. I mean, I haven't seen that movie forever. Jeez.
That movie's horrible.
Yeah.
Not even the right way. I mean, it's fun, I guess, but
yeah,
the whole like first 10 minutes of that movie is this old farmer dude talking to his dog. That's the first 10 minutes of the movie.
Well, the first 10 minutes of this movie have Billy's father, Randall Peltzer, in Chinatown. And, of course, you know, he buys the Mogwai from an old Chinese man played by Ki Luke. And this is the second movie produced or directed by Steven Spielberg that came out in 1984 that features a young Asian kid in a New York Yankees hat.
Well, you know, when they first he first appears during like the father's voiceover, he's wearing like the cap, and then like, you know, this little kid dressed like Short Round, you know, is walking in front of him. That's definitely like, you know, the first thing that ran through my head.
Yeah.
Rewatching the film, yeah.
And can I say that Hoyt Axton, who plays Randall Peltzer, is basically Chris Pratt 30 years from now?
Think so?
I totally do. Like, the whole movie, all I kept thinking was, like, this guy would, like, 30 years before Gremlins, Hoyt Axton was probably, like, you know.
Flash Gordon?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I don't, like, he has, like, the way he delivers lines and stuff, it just reminded me of Chris Pratt a little bit.
It's a practice, well, like a practice salesman, I guess.
Yeah. And, like, when he's in the shop, and he says something to the effect of, like, you got a mean case of dragon breath. And then you hear the gong sound. It's so corny, but it kind of works a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, how do you not buy something at Fu Manchu's, like, store?
Oh, that cataract, man. That makes him mystical and scary.
He drove, like, with cataracts.
Do you take any offense to the sort of Asian stereotyping of his character?
I think there are certain instances of it, you know, because I'd watched this film as a kid and didn't necessarily see it as such. It wasn't until older that you really kind of got like the meaning of it. I don't think this character is mean spirited.
No.
So in this instance, I don't necessarily take offense for it. That's just a symptom of the time. And there are points, of course, you know, it's not like, even with like Mickey Rooney, like Breakfast at Tiffany's, you know, I'm generally okay with that. It can be upsetting for someone who's a first time viewer, but I guess with prior experience, I think, especially when it comes to minority experience, particularly Asians, considering there's such a smaller percentage of them compared to other minorities in the United States, I kind of feel that there's a mentality of a lot of times you're used to just letting things go. And I think in this instance, that's one of those examples where, you know, I just kind of accept it. But like I said, I don't take offense necessarily because it's not mean spirited. So that's pretty much the dividing line. I think, in my opinion, I may feel differently if I saw a film from the same era that doesn't handle the character quite as well, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Sorry to get serious on you for a second.
That's okay. I talk about this. This is something that's on my mind pretty frequently.
Yeah. Well, I imagine so.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, do you have any favorite moments or anything like specifically that you want to talk about for Gremlins?
You know, I really like, I guess, like the intro scene with Gizmo. Gizmo's such an adorable little dude. And I really like, I guess, the finale in the department store at the end with Billy versus Stripe with Gizmo helping out.
Yeah.
That's a lot of fun. I think we mentioned earlier that the scene when the mother confronts like the newly transformed gremlins.
Love that scene. And that scene is so, man, it's like, it's brutal, but it's really funny.
It really is. Like, you know, I imagined literally watching it. I imagined replacing the music in that film with like Captain America music. She's holding the little tray.
Yeah.
And like when she runs up to that thing using it as a shield, and then she stabs it to death like two or three times.
Yeah, like man, how many of them does she kill? Like four?
She kills like three, right?
Well, like one gets ground up in the mixer. That's the first one.
Yeah, the mixer.
And then she stabs one like it's Marion Crane in the shower from Psycho.
And then it was the microwave.
Then the head explodes in the microwave oven. I was a bit shocked having not seen Gremlins for so long, but like, I don't know. Like, I just didn't remember it.
So brutal, right?
Yeah, like, I didn't remember it being so like.
Well, it wasn't brutal as in, because it's all cartoony, but like, I didn't necessarily remember how
it's still shocking, though.
Like, I mean, Mr. Murray and his, like, sweet, sweet wife get run over by their plow.
That's Futterman, yeah.
Futterman, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He's great, though. Dick Miller plays Murray Futterman, and, He is a character, and I'm sure that you know you can expand on this, but like in the 1980s, there was a bit of sort of pushback against the invasion of Asian culture and foreign built electronics and automobiles began to like. Affect
yes,
American I've companies.
Gung ho.
Yeah. In that scene where he's like, he's just talking to Billy and he's like, you know, Billy's car doesn't work. The VW. And so he's talking about how, you know, the cheap foreign cars and then he points to his tractor and he's like, that's a Kentucky Harvester. And he takes incredible pride in the fact that it's a Kentucky Harvester. And he's sort of very pro-American, anti-Japanese, you know, and his opinions reflect the cultural attitude of the 1980s. I don't know if you remember, but like by the mid 80s, there was a campaign by American companies that was used to sort of like boost sales and smear, not necessarily like smear, but to kind of combat foreign companies when they started putting those "Made in the USA" labels on everything.
Well, of course, we know now that it failed, considering how much everything is made outside of the United States.
Yeah, but I guess my point is that his character is a very realistic look at some Americans during that time.
Yeah, I mean, I guess at the end though, he probably wished that his plow was made overseas that it would fail.
I guess so.
Good old American workmanship, I guess. Worked out for him.
Yeah. Well, even later, like. You know what, the scene right before the plow scene, when the gremlins, you know, are sort of invading the town, and they like screw with Futterman's like TV antenna.
He's watching a subtitle film and he just kind of harumphs.
He's like goddamn foreign TV. He's like, I told you we should have bought a Zenith. And Zenith was at the time like the biggest American brand still being manufactured inside the U.S. But there's two things in that scene that are absolutely priceless, I think. And one of them is the giant Nixon poster that he has by his front door. The other thing is, you already mentioned it, but once the gremlins mess with his antenna, the only thing he can clearly get reception on is a subtitled movie.
Do you happen to know what movie that is that they're playing?
Talk about irony. No, I don't know. Like, I thought it would be something famous, but I didn't recognize it right off the bat.
I can't even remember what the subtitle was. I mean, you're talking like a 2-second clip.
So. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's not like Bells of St. Mary's where they have an extended bit of it, but...
Or It's a Wonderful Life, which is also in it, too. Yeah.
So, were there any scenes in particular that you really enjoyed? Besides the ones I mentioned, I guess.
Well, I really do love the scene with the mother in the kitchen. Like, that's maybe my favorite scene in the movie.
Well, like, I think, like, after... after she kills the third one, it's before she gets ambushed by the one in the tree. You know, she goes to like the knife block, pulls out one, and then she pauses for a second.
And she gets a second one.
She gets a second one? I was like, she's ready for it.
She's badass, yeah. And you know, that's the same actress who plays Lorraine Baines's Lorraine Baines's mother in Back to the Future.
Is it?
Yeah, so we had a Back to the Future tie-in in our Superman episode with Jimmy Olsen, and now we have Billy's mother is a Back to the Future tie-in.
Yeah.
It's telling us something.
Why don't we talk a little bit about Phoebe Cates? She's not in it that much, but, you know, watching the film, you know, I think she's always been kind of like a, I guess she is a sex icon, but don't necessarily think that's all she is. You know, I was really surprised. I don't know why, but I forgot that she was in the movie.
I think it's interesting because Fast Times was what, like 2 years before this?
Yeah.
I think Fast Times came out in 1982.
Yes, I believe so.
So, like, yeah, so she was sort of introduced to the world as like, sexy heartthrob, you know. She's got that scene by the pool. And I love that we're introduced to her in, like, the most mom-looking outfit ever at the bank.
That's pretty cool out there.
Yeah. But she's not made up to look sexy at all. She's made up to look like, you know, your average sort of suburban girl next door. So, but
yeah, you know, when she's working at the bank, she's wearing that like full body dress with like shoulder pads and stuff. And,
yeah.
You know, she's still pretty cute though.
Like, oh yeah.
I think the moment of kind of like drama that they give her is when she's talking about how, you know, the reason why she dislikes Christmas, you know, for some reason, like that whole, like, I remembered her disliking Christmas, but I couldn't remember why until like she said it again. And when she started telling the story, I was like, oh yeah, what the fuck.
Well, you know, the studio wanted that scene out of the movie, and you know, Dante kind of fought against them, and eventually they brought Spielberg in and was like, you know, you got to get this out of here. And so Spielberg called Dante into his office and was like, what is it with this scene, like, it, you know, it doesn't make any sense to me. And Dante like made his case for it, and Spielberg apparently was like, you know, it's your movie, all right, keep it in, you know, but I don't get it at all. And I agree that it seems to come out of like left field from like a different movie, but I don't know, not really, maybe. Like, there's so much like weird stuff like coming together. It's like a salad bowl. This Gremlins movie, it's a salad bowl. and I think, I don't know, I think, the more I think about it, I think it fits.
Yeah, I guess so. Like, so is she like a transplant to the neighborhood, or to the town?
Yeah, because Billy would have known that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that part of it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, but, you know, because everybody would have known what was happening.
Yeah. And, like, what's up with, like, Judge Reinhold being, like, a dick?
Judge Reinhold's a dick in everything. Fast Times, his character Brad's kind of a dick.
Literally has a dick out.
What's funny, because
Merry Christmas, guys. I'm sorry about that.
he's sort of like a foil for Billy, and it's another one of those like 1980s things. Like, you know, he's got that line where he's like, "The world's changing, Peltzer. You got to change with it. You got to be tough." And he, you know, and Billy's a, you know, Mr. Futterman asked Billy about how his comic book is coming along, and which is, I'll come back to that in a second because I think there's something funny about that. But so we learn that Billy is sort of like a creative person. You know, he wants to be an artist, and Judge Reinhold is, you know, the other side of that coin. He's the businessman. He's the very professional driven character. He even says, by the time I'm 30, I'm going to be a millionaire. And I think that's sort of like that push-pull dynamic of, you know, like America in the 80s, moving to that sort of like greedy Wall Street version of itself is sort of vaguely present in this movie. But
yeah, I'd say so. I mean, he really only appears in like the beginning of the film. So
yeah,
I guess like there's I guess it, unless I'm mistaken, is his fate like not explored?
No.
Yeah,
but Mrs. Deagle's is.
Oh man, it was pretty. You know, I really didn't like. I remembered her dying that way. I didn't remember like the speed at which it happened, though.
Well, Mrs. Deagle is a great character, and she's sort of like a cross, you know, in my mind, she's like a cross between Ebenezer Scrooge and Elvira Gulch from The Wizard of Oz.
Well, you know, I mean, she kind of, okay, go ahead.
Well, I mean, you know, she's sort of got that sort of greedy bah humbug quality to her, obviously, but she's also got that sort of like twisted wicked witch quality to her as well. And the whole thing about her wanting to take Billy's dog and kill it is very Wizard of Ozzy with Mrs. Gulch and Toto.
Yeah, I was waiting for her to say that. I think in my mind, I remembered her saying a line saying, and your little doggy too. Like I remembered in my mind, I remembered it, but when I rewatched it, she didn't actually say it. So,
well, her death is hilarious to me. Because it's another great Wizard of Oz reference. Like, I don't know if you noticed, but like...
Well, when when the cops find her, Jonathan Banks, they find her, you know, on her back, right? With like her stockings, like up in the air.
Yeah, her legs are up in the snow and she's got red slippers on. She's got fucking ruby slippers on.
Well, I mean, she's a real estate mogul in this small ass town, I guess.
Yeah, well, but
finer things.
Dante does something that's very subtle, and you, if you blink, you could miss it. Like she lands next to like a picket fence, and light is coming through the picket fence, and her shadow from the legs is falling into the snow, but the light like the from the picket fence make it stripes. Yeah, which is so it's basically a recreation of like the house falling on the Wicked Witch of the East. At the beginning of The Wizard of Oz. Like, it's, like, I love that. Like, that kind of, like, little, like, you know, Hollywood historical, like, reference, like, just, I don't know, it tickles me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that scene is super memorable. Especially considering how much of a bitch she is in the entire film.
Well, and she dies because the gremlins mess with her mechanical chair. The one, like, the stair chair, or whatever you call it. So, like... Did you know that the term gremlin was coined by Roald Dahl?
I did not.
The guy who wrote Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory?
I didn't.
Yeah, he wrote a 1940... Reference. Sorry, he wrote a 1943 story about mischievous elves that caused damage to RAF planes during World War II.
Okay, so like the classic definition of gremlins.
Yeah. Walt Disney originally developed an animated movie version, but eventually abandoned it. And Warner Brothers created a Merry Melodies short with Bugs Bunny called Falling Hair, in which Bugs battles a gremlin on a U.S. Army bomber.
Yeah, I've seen that one.
Yeah. Gremlins, course, it was a huge success.
More people know, I guess that was weird. More people know the Twilight Zone episode, I imagine, or at least are aware of that reference.
You mean the one on the airplane with like that they recreate with William Shatner?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. Or is it John? Wait, William Shatner's in the original one.
John Lithgow's
in the movie version. Yeah. Okay.
Well, no, not the movie version. That was like the '80s TV show version, right?
Are you sure it's not the movie?
No, the Twilight Zone movie is like original stories. I'm pretty sure.
All right, I'll take your word for it. I haven't seen that movie forever.
I've seen it, I guess.
Yeah. But I'm definitely very familiar with both the John Lithgow and the William Shatner one. I thought the Lithgow one was in the movie, but I will certainly take your word for it. Give me a second here. Okay, sorry about that. And originally, the filmmakers tested the use of monkeys for gremlin characters. Did you know that?
Nope.
Yeah. Apparently they
research about this movie after watching it.
Yeah, so. They abandoned that when the first test monkey they used panicked whenever they would put the prosthetic head on it.
Yeah, that was probably a good decision.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, what other interesting trivia can you recall from the movie?
Well, I mean, not a whole lot, but I mean, obviously, you know, it's probably well known that this movie and other films that were sort of like, there were PG movies that featured significantly dark material, like Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and Gremlins, really pushed the MPAA to create the PG-13 rating. And the PG-13 rating, Gremlins came out, if I'm not mistaken, in June of 1984. And Red Dawn came out in August of 1984, so 2 months later, and it was the first PG-13 movie. So that's pretty quick. Also, and this is funny, the novelization for Gremlins apparently creates like an elaborate backstory for the Mogwai, and the Mogwai was like created by aliens. I read the paragraph from the novel that explains the origin of the Mogwai, and it's really just sort of like batshit crazy. It might be worth tracking down for those who are interested.
I'm interested now. A lot of those weird, like, I guess, movie adaptations for novelizations always have like a weird little tidbits of additional story that, you know, doesn't necessarily add to the film, but they really diverge in really interesting ways. I know a lot of like horror films, particularly like Friday the 13th or the Halloween movies, their novelizations add like a lot of weird stuff to them.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a big thing in the 80s, was like getting the novelization of the movie. We do have Corey Feldman in this movie, who is obviously also in Gremlins. So two movies written by Chris Columbus and produced by Steven Spielberg. He's pretty good in this.
You mean Goonies, right?
Goonies. What did I say?
You said Gremlins again.
Oh, yeah, he's in Gremlins and Goonies. And he's pretty good in this as Pete.
As a tree.
I like the scene where he sort of like bats his eyes at Gizmo. It's just sort of like adorable. Corey Feldman was an adorable kid.
I think he's, I guess he's seemingly more likable in here than he is as Mouth, though, probably. Just a nicer kid.
No, but he's great as Mouth, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
I like that there's sort of like airplanes peppered in, going along with like the origin of the term gremlin. Like there, like Corey Feldman's bedroom, where he's like fighting off the gremlins, and he like uses scissors to cut the Christmas lights so that they fall out of his window. Behind him, there's like a giant, like it looks like an inflatable biplane, like behind him. And on the wall of the tavern, what's it called?
Doobies,
Dory's.
Dories.
Dory's Tavern. So yeah. So like there's pictures of airplanes on the wall in Dory's Tavern also.
Interesting.
You know what I find interesting is that a high school science teacher is in his classroom at 2:20 a.m.
What else is this guy doing? Like, is he, I'm a teacher, but I really haven't given up the pursuit for science.
Right. Well, all he does is draw a little blood from the Mogwai, right? So,
Yeah, I mean,
like,
what happens with that?
why is he there like 12 hours after school gets out? What is he doing? It's like a complete, like, crazy mad scientist scene that they create with that, though. Like, and of course, he's eating his lunch at 2:20 just so that he can leave it there and the gremlin can have it.
The guy was asking for it.
I know. I love that guy, though. Like, what's his name? Glenn Turman. He's been in so many things. Like, you recognize him, but you just don't know his name. He's one of those great character actors.
What else has he been in?
I don't know, man. Stop putting me on the spot. A ton of stuff.
You're saying that.
Yeah. I remember seeing him on like a bunch of like TV shows and things like that. Like, he was everywhere in the 80s. He was like 1980s television Morgan Freeman. He was everywhere.
I was just looking him up. He was in Cooley High, JD's Revenge, Buffalo Soldiers, Light It Up, Sahara with Penelope Cruz.
Yeah, and Matthew McConaughey and Steve Zahn.
Oh, wait a minute. Wait, he's in Super 8. Does he play the teacher in Super 8?
I don't know. You know that movie way better than I do.
He is.
You love that movie.
Mr. Woodward. He is Mr. Woodward. What a great callback.
What a great callback that you had no idea of until right now.
Yep.
That still doesn't explain what the hell he's doing on school property at 2:20 in the morning.
maybe that's his type, you know? Just he's studying aliens and, like, with his weird little, like, trailer that he takes stuff from kids.
Oh, man.
All right. I guess, any last thoughts?
I don't know.
Yeah, this is a long episode where we
Gizmo riding the Barbie dream car was like one of the biggest merchandising like images that they used for the film, but it's pretty cool.
I think a scene I thought was really cool is, you know, of course the part where Stripe jumps into the YMCA pool.
Oh, that shot's amazing with
it's
like the
slow pan back into like the boiling cauldron of a pool.
Yeah, yeah, that
and then you just see a shadow of like a Billy just like oh. Running away. It's really good.
Well, the gremlins at the movie theater was a big like point as well. Like I remember they used that in a bunch of like the TV commercials at the time and stuff.
Yeah.
And the fact that they sort of like blow up the movie theater is like very Inglorious Bastards.
Yeah. You know, like when I thought about that, it made, you know, probably one of the reasons why I thought about the blob on that set is because of the movie theater scene too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, on the movie theater marquee at the beginning of the film, before they put Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs on it, it's
Boys Town or something.
No, it's This Boy's Life and Watch the Skies, which were the working titles of E.T. and Close Encounters.
Yeah, so. Boys Town's a Christmas movie.
It is. Spencer Tracy, yeah. And you know what? Stripe fucking stands by that fountain for, like, ever at the end of the movie. Like, for real. Like, he's standing there and he's like, aha, Billy, look at me. It's like a James Bond moment. Like, he's fucking telling James Bond the whole story and then James Bond gets the drop on him. Like, that's exactly what Stripe does at the end of the movie. I guess that's what we like, though. Like, for real. Like, it's that kind of, like... That sort of like extended like peak moment that audiences love, you know?
Yeah. It's like, I mean, he's got a gun. Let him shoot the gun. Like Hitchcock said, show a gun. Let him, you better be fired by the end of the movie.
It's the anticipation that we love. Come on.
I guess so.
That hanging on that moment.
He only puts his finger in the fountain.
Yeah. It's like, you know, the bottom of the ninth inning and two men are out and you're down by a run and, you know, here comes the pitch, like that kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay. Baseball season isn't for like,
except that the pitch is Gizmo, like flying off and bringing the sunshine and destroying everything.
Yeah.
You just got to wait for the sequel.
Have you seen the second one recently at all?
No.
Yeah, me neither. I don't think we should do an episode on it, but I do want to revisit it sometime. Sometime soon.
Yeah, well, the second one, if I remember correctly, is it basically like the tavern scene, you know, where like Dante
just,
has tremendous fun.
Right?
What's that?
They're just in a film, like a TV studio or something.
Yeah. But like, you know, like the scene where like Kate is bartending for the gremlins in Dory's Tavern. Like, that's the scene I think that Dante probably had the most fun shooting, because there's all these, like, little things, like, that are happening in it, and they really walks the line between, like, I don't know, mischievous and rowdy, and, like, the evil, murderous nature of, like, the gremlins.
Yeah, you see like one gremlin with a sock over its head and a pistol.
Yeah, it's dealing with gremlins is like dealing with like drunk teenagers, apparently.
Really drunk teenagers.
Yeah. But like you got that great shot of like the gremlin that has like the leg warmers on.
Flash dance.
Like. It has like yeah, it has like that aerobicizing moment where like it, like he cuts back and forth between different angles of the legs.
Yeah, it's upside down.
Yeah. It's terrific. And then there's the scene with like the Flasher Gremlin. Remember we had the Flasher Gremlin forever at Suncoast?
Yeah.
Man, I remember that it took, we sold a bunch of those, but like the Flasher Gremlin, it took forever to sell that one originally. And then when the gremlin points the gun at Kate and she sort of bobs her head, the camera like bobs the other direction both times. So like it, you kind of get like a very cartoony moment there, but it's really fun. So like that scene I like a lot. So, and you've got like the film noir, like Philip Marlowe, private eye, like gremlin off in the corner and
the puppets and breakdancing gremlin.
Yeah. There's all kinds of stuff. So they just have a lot of fun with it. I had a lot of fun rewatching this movie actually. So
yeah, me too.
I didn't actually remember that I liked this movie this much, but I do. So there you go.
It was a great choice.
It was. It was your choice, so thank you. Thank you for doing that.
You're welcome, CJ.
Yeah, man. So, that was your Christmas gift to me, was making me watch Gremlins.
All right. What are you going to do for me then?
I don't know. I'm going to...
Your choice, man. Make sure it doesn't suck.
You mean for our next movie?
Yeah, I guess so.
Oh, shit. You're going to have to give me some time to... I don't know. We talked about doing East of Eden. Do you want to do that?
Yeah, sure. I think... pretty sure I still have the DVD somewhere.
We're going to go from... well, Gremlins is not a contemporary film by any means, but we're going to go from a movie that was released during our lifetime to a movie that was released well before our lifetime.
Yeah.
Yes, I think that's good. We'll, after Christmas, we'll do East of Eden.
Okay.
So... I don't really have anything else on Gremlins, I guess, you know, but it was tremendous fun and you know, being the first Amblin movie, it was certainly the beginning of,
beginning of greatness.
Yeah. I mean, whatever you want to, you know, it was the beginning of a legacy, I guess, for that company. So Cool. Anything else you want to add on before we sign off?
No, I think I'm sorted.
Okay. Well, I'd like to take this opportunity to wish everyone out there a happy holiday, a Merry Christmas, Hanukkah, whatever you guys celebrate. Please be safe. Don't drink and drive. Watch a lot of movies. Have some fun. And we'll see you after the first of the year, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so, for whenever.
Yeah.
We can work out the scheduling, I guess, so we'll see.
So, certainly, for you and your family, Cesar, I wish you all a happy holiday as well.
I hope the same to you.
Thank you.
Ditto to everyone else as well.
Cool. All right, guys. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Facebook and all that good stuff. You can find me at Setting the Frame on Twitter. And for Cesar, go ahead.
You can find me at filmsmash.com. We actually have a new contest up, so it's good until the end of the year. So I think by the time this episode goes up, you guys should be able to still enter and win a Blu-ray copy of The Adventurers starring Andy Lau and Jean Reno.
Nice. Cool. Yep. And at Junior Beho on Twitter, right?
That is correct.
Cool.
If I ever update on Twitter, but I guess I should start New Year's resolution and all that.
And both of us are on Letterboxd, so if anybody's on Letterboxd, you can follow us, and I'm sure we'll follow you back.
Yeah, absolutely. So.
All right, man. Well, have a great holiday, and we'll see you guys next time for East of Eden.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Bye. Celluloid Jelly was recorded using Google Hangouts, mixed using Apple's GarageBand software, and hosted by Podbean. For any inquiries related to Celluloid Jelly, please email settingtheframe@gmail.com.